From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 23rd day of September 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois. And Pete Labatt will be here to talk about the agricultural weather forecast. He's a meteorologist. Along the way, we'll hear from Dave Dickey. He'll have all the agricultural news for the day. I'll remind you that it's National Farm Safety and Health Week. If you haven't taken time to get down off of that combine yet and take a little afternoon nap, this might be a good time to do that. And then in the second half hour of our program, we'll dip into the archives and hear from the National Resource Energy Laboratory. It all happens on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago on this Thursday afternoon, futures finished the day lower in the wheat pit, down 22.5 cents today in the nearby December. At a settlement price at $6.97 and a quarter. The March at $7.28 and a quarter, down 22, and next year's July or the harvest month at $7.28 and a quarter for the soft red, down 14.5 cents. Nearby hard red at $7.37 and a quarter on a settlement price in Kansas City, down 19 cents. Back in Chicago, corn pit $4.99 and a quarter, down 5 3/4. March at $5.12 and a quarter, down 6. May futures in the corn pit $5.18 and a quarter, 6 1/4 lower. July at $5.21 and a quarter, down 8.5, and September at $4.96 and a quarter, 3.5 lower. December of next year at $4.75 3/4, down 1 3/4. January beans at $11.03 and a quarter, up 4 3/4. The nearby November contract at $10.93 and a half, up 5. The March at $11.10 3/4, up 4.5, and next year's November at $10.78 and a quarter, a nickel higher there as well. Bean meal at $3.05.50, down 70. Oil at $43.51, 64 cents higher. Live cattle futures October contract 96.12 and a half, a nickel lower. September feeders at 109.10, down 15 cents. And October lean hogs today at $78.42 and a half, down 27 and a half cents on this Thursday afternoon. You are listening, of course, to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Let's take a look at the outside markets at this hour. Nearby crude oil futures in the November contract, $75 even a barrel, up 29 cents. Ethanol at $1.94 and 9 cents, down 5 6 cents. Natural gas at $4.04, up 4 8 cents. And the heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.11. That's 0.3 cents higher on the afternoon. Gold futures at $1,294.30 an ounce, up $4.10. The Dow at 10,702, just about 37 points lower. The dollar at 80.02 is up 0.19, and the CRB at 280.14 is 1.25 higher on the day. Here's what the weather forecast looks like for the Urbana-Champaign area for this afternoon. Yet mostly sunny skies, a high near 92 degrees. South-southwest winds between 15 and 20. They'll gust as high as 30 today. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms likely after 1 a.m., mostly cloudy. A low of just 67 degrees. South-southwest winds between 14 and 15. Gusting to 25. Chance of precip this evening, 70%, says the National Weather Service. Friday, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms. That before 1 p.m. Cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny. A high near 78 degrees. Friday, it'll be breezy throughout the day. West winds between 15 and 20 miles an hour. They'll gust up to 25 miles an hour. Then Friday night, mostly clear. A low around 51 degrees. Northwest winds between 6 and 10 miles an hour. When we get to Saturday, it'll be sunny. The high near 73. Saturday night, the low of 50. Partly cloudy. Sunday, a chance of showers, 30%. Partly sunny and a high near 71 degrees. We'll have a more complete look at the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour. And we talk with meteorologist Pete Labatt.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
The Closing Market Report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from L&M Commodities, a full-service brokerage company serving area farmers with professional market advice and crop insurance products. L&M Commodities has offices in New Market, Indiana, Leland, Illinois, and Terrell, Arkansas.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Thursday afternoon. On the phone line with us today, as usual, is Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois. It's a beautiful day, Dan. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome, Todd.
I'm still busy there in Decatur, I bet.
Yeah, it's the tempo has definitely picked up since harvest has begun.
Lots of truck traffic. Harder to get into work in the morning?
Well, I come early enough, I miss a lot of it, but there's definitely a good activity of trucks coming in and out of Decatur.
I made my way across across through Hayworth and 136 from Champaign all the way over to Atlanta and into McLean today on the farm. Probably some folks you know. I bet you know the Adams, Sue and John Adams, and Farm
yes.
Credit. Farm Credit was there. And they were serving them lunch and some of their neighbors, too. It was awful nice. It's National Farm Safety and Health Week. Just reminding folks to, you know, to take their time out there during the harvest season and be safe. Farm Credit wants you to do that, and we'd like you to do that, too. And so they just had us over, and we had a nice lunch with them. I talked with them for quite a while. Have you been to the Corn Belters? You live there in Bloomington Normal, or had, and I still think you do. Have you been?
I'm still there, but I'm in the process of moving.
Yeah. Are you moving all the way to Texas?
No, I'm moving to Decatur.
Oh.
I'm going to stop in Decatur for a few years before I make it on to Texas.
Yeah, well, we'll hear not today, but later, and maybe this week, tomorrow yet, or next week. I talked with Sue and John. They were part of the corn growers' push to educate Washington leaders about the family farm culture that still exists. And if you've been to the Corn Belters or the Corn Crib, that's the new semi-pro team there in Normal, you'll find them on the wall. John said they're next to the bathrooms. but anyway, besides that, we probably ought to talk, I suppose, about what's happening in the marketplace. Why don't you first tell me about the fundamentals and what they look like to you as you hear about the numbers that are coming in off the farm?
Well, the corn yields definitely here in the Eastern Corn Belt are coming in under expectations, and in some cases very disappointing. Now, that does not mean that there are not some good yields out there. There's a big degree of variability, but when the smoke clears, it does seem to feel that the overall average, at least here in the key parts of Illinois, could be down 20% or so. So the trade continues to hear those type of numbers. Now, we're starting to get a few reports out of Iowa. Some add expectations, and then on the other hand, then they fall back too. So Iowa is not, at least the early parts of Iowa, what we're hearing, is not necessarily consistent. That would maybe say that the USDA yield is going to hold up in the long run. But it's still early. They've had a lot of rain out there, so a lot of harvest is being delayed. I think the trade, the corn, is still looking for a lower production number as we look ahead toward that October crop report.
Of course, we're at a fairly large production number, 163.5 on the national average yield. How much lower are they looking, do you think?
Well, everybody likes to take a step at a time, but you know, my guess is the trade's going to look for at least another couple bushels anyway. Come on down to 161.5, maybe 160.5. Now there's still people out in the trade desk touting numbers under that, but I think you have to probably let Iowa get a little further down the road before you'd want to, you know, dip down below the 160 mark, at least for right now.
Well,
anyway,
you don't want to go as low as Dan Bossie, is that what you're saying?
Well,
I'm not. You know what? I retract the question.
I don't know. Yeah. I do know that the crop supplies are going to be under what demand is in some areas, and you know. we're probably going to have to see some form of rationing of inventories take place over the next, several months.
All right. Well, I suppose that's where we really need to start. Where does rationing begin? It's not here. I don't think so.
It probably is to a certain extent. There probably are people like hog producers may put any kind of expansion plans on hold for a while. I don't think you've seen any cutbacks, but I think as far as expansion plans go, maybe some of that has taken place. But no, there's a general feeling that little, if any, demand has been cut back anyway for the time being. But a lot of that will depend, too, on, energy costs have a big say about that. And when it comes to ethanol grind, the blend economics, we've been in a period where blending has been favorable, so we've had more blending than what was mandated over the past year. So, but if grind margins begin to deteriorate, then you will see the blending margins come back, and we'll maybe use less ethanol. So, but at least at the moment, blending economics are very favorable. So you've got a lot of the ethanol people still grinding away.
Can we talk about soybeans for a second? The market is always right. I suppose that's where you're supposed to start. The market is always right. But the question is, fundamentally, do you think the soybean market can support the level it's at this point?
Well, today is the highest close of the move. But the thing that I think I want to point out this week is we're getting a little noise from spread unwinding, the trade that was very heavily long corn, short soybeans for this last leg up, and we're seeing unwinding of that. So that kind of explains some of the weakness that we're seeing in the corn market this week and some of the strength that we're seeing in soybeans this week, especially as we grind our way here to the end of the month, into the quarter. So I think we're getting some noise from that point of view. The other thing is as you look ahead, where the market is starting to focus on the South American crop, and no matter which way you look at it, when you start comparing current estimates to last year's estimate, South America is always going to show a smaller crop than last year because they had a near-perfect or perfect growing season last year. Yields went through the roof and a big supply. So if they go back to something more normal, and that is what people are expecting, that South America is not going to come out with as big a crop as they had a year ago. So that in the South is going to be generally positive. There is noise and concern that the El Nino weather pattern may come in here and begin to ding up the South American crop as we go forward. So that is encouraging buying here of the U.S. Inventories. And this week we saw a million-ton sales totally go on beans. So $10 level hasn't really showed any indication of slowing export interest on soybeans. So, and then as we look down the road, if corn prices go higher to try to encourage larger acres next year, probably beans are going to have a setback, or we may end up producing a crop that's not as big as this year. And again, that carryover comes down. So people will look ahead at distant carryover projections. And right at the moment, I know, yes, when you look at just the current supply-demand year and the yields that you're hearing in the eastern Corn Belt, it looks like beans could get a little heavy at some point in time, but I'm not too sure they're ready to get heavy yet. I think the South American crop needs to get a little further down the road.
Yeah, and still, if you look at the beans, there isn't any carry in the market to speak of.
No, and there probably soon won't be in corn either. I think you can kind of see what's happening in the corn. Your December contract is gaining on your distant contracts, and that is basically telling you that you're in a bull market characteristic. And what that is discouraging selling or discouraging storage and encouraging movement into the marketplace. And that's the way bull markets act, is that you don't have carrying charges because the market's telling the farmer that we want your grain now. We don't want you to store it.
Is the market right?
You're the one that said the market is right. Now, is right at any given one day, but it does have the right to change its mind the next day.
It always does. Thanks much, Dan.
Very well.
Dan Zwickers with ADM Grain Group. He's in Decatur, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Thursday afternoon. You can always hear him again if you'd like on our website at willag.org.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Dave Dickey is here now with today's agricultural news.
In agricultural news, the owner of one of the two Iowa egg farms linked to as many as 1,600 salmonella illnesses declined to testify at a congressional hearing yesterday, citing his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. The CEO of Hillendale Farms, Orland Bethel, would not answer questions before the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Investigations. Before lawmakers called Bethel to testify, two witnesses recounted how they were sickened by tainted eggs. The chairman of the subcommittee, Bart Stupak, a Democrat from Michigan, said the outbreaks paints, quote, a very disturbing picture of egg production in America. A French business daily today says that Louis Dreyfus is considering a merger with fellow commodities group Olam International. Singapore-based Olam is one of Asia's largest commodities firms with activities in supply chain management and processing of a wide range of agricultural products and generated total revenue of $10.5 billion in its 2010 fiscal year. McDonald's Corporation is boosting its quarterly dividend 11% to 61 cents. McDonald's says today that the dividend will be paid on December 15th to shareholders of record on December 1st. CEO Jim Skinner said in a statement that about $5 billion in total cash will be returned to stockholders in 2010, split between dividends and buybacks. A new media poll today shows that Democratic Senator Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, the Agriculture Committee chair, remains far behind in an uphill battle for re-election. Republican John Boozman, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, holds a hefty 14-point lead among likely voters. The poll found some glimmers of hope for Lincoln, though. Lincoln has seen a 10 percentage point improvement since mid-July in being seen as someone who will, quote, fight for Main Street over Wall Street, while Boozman has seen a drop of 4 points. The canola crop in Canada's top two growing provinces may be the lowest quality in 5 years after widespread frost halted growth in immature plants. Frost will also reduce yields in up to one quarter of crops in areas such as western Saskatchewan. Canada is the world's top exporter of canola and rapeseed. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Thursday afternoon. If you missed one of our programs or you'd like to hear something again, that's pretty easy to do. You can always visit our website. The address is willag.org, willag.org. Not long after we're on the radio with our programming, we post it to the website, sometimes even before we get things on the radio. It's all there at willag.org in its entirety, from the pre-opening market report to the closing market report, everything in between. And our weekend program, we call that Commodity Week, posted about 6 o'clock on Friday nights. Hey, you know, it's National Farm Safety and Health Week, and the Safety Council is reminding farmers and ranchers to take care during the harvest season. I'll have more in just a moment on the nation's most dangerous job and what the very first person on the scene of a farm accident should not do. Each year, there are some 80,000 farm-related injuries around the nation. Most of the time, these injuries involve machinery, usually a hand, an arm, or a foot, a leg, caught up in a fast-moving tool. Well, University of Illinois Extension Farm Safety Specialist Bob Heron says it's a common accident and one where it's best to leave the victim in place and wait for the first responders.
A lot of our extremity injuries, so to the hands, arms, and legs, that get caught in a piece of equipment or whatever. Normally, just from what happens, a person gets entangled in equipment, and from a first aid standpoint, if somebody comes on the scene, the mistake they often make is try to pull them out. They want to shut the equipment off, of course, if it isn't shut off, but often they should leave the victim in the machine unless there's some danger of fire or whatever, so that if and call for help for an emergency crew to come out that has training to deal with a person who's in that situation.
Well, once the victim is freed, Heron says they can quickly lose blood and go into shock. It's important for the first person on the scene to shut down and stabilize the equipment, call an emergency crew, and then wait for them to make a decision about how best to proceed with the extraction.
Another issue in farms this time of year is children. Now, we have a number of injuries with children because they come home from school, for example, or on weekends, and they want to be out where the excitement is, particularly boys, our research shows. And so they want to get out and they want to play, they want to be on the equipment, riding on the equipment. It all looks very exciting to them. But we need to realize that allowing children to ride on our equipment is putting them at significant risk because they can easily be thrown off the equipment because most of our equipment doesn't have any shock absorption in it, like a tractor, except in the operator's seat, and wagons and so on and so forth are very little. And it's very easy for them to be thrown off the equipment and be run over by the machine before we could stop it.
Bob Heron is always concerned about farm kids during the harvest season. He has no doubt the pressure to bring in the crop will cause moms and dads to ask too much of their offspring too soon.
They are very much at risk to accidents because one example is that they have very significant limitations. They may look like an adult and act to some degree like an adult, but they have one limitation is simultaneous motor skills. Where you have to move, if something goes wrong with the tractor, for example, it goes down in a ditch or whatever, and you've got to turn the steering wheel one direction, push in on the clutch with your foot, and maybe take an implement out of the field with a hydraulic system. You got to do that all at once to get the machine under control, and we don't develop our capacity as human beings to do that very well until we're between 13 and 15 or 16 years of age.
On the subject of kids, the younger ones will play in the gravity flow wagons. It's easy to get stuck and sucked down and suffocated as those wagons empty. Don't let that happen. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Thursday afternoon. Stay with us. In just 2 minutes, I'll talk with agricultural meteorologist Pete Levitt.
St. Clair of Assisi Day, patron of good weather. It's also the first day of autumn. On this day in agricultural history in 1861, Robert Bosch was born, a German engineer and industrialist. He was responsible for the invention of the spark plug. In 1869, Mary Mallon was born. She is better known by her nickname, Typhoid Mary. She was an infamous household cook who was responsible for major outbreaks of typhoid in New York City in 1904, 1907, and 1914. In all, she was directly responsible for 3 deaths and 51 cases of typhoid. Ironically, she was herself immune to typhoid fever. And in 1880, Sir John Boyd Orr was born, a Scottish scientist and nutrition expert. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work to eliminate world hunger. In 1936, he published a report, Food, Health, and Income, a dietary survey by income groups made during 1935. It showed that the cost of a diet fulfilling basic nutritional requirements was beyond the means of half of the British population, and that 10% of the population was undernourished. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Listening to the closing market report, it's a Thursday afternoon. Pete Leavitt, agricultural meteorologist, joins us to take a look at the weather forecast for the Midwest, the nation, and the globe. Good afternoon to you, Pete.
Good afternoon, Todd.
A little rainfall overnight. There's we've had rainfall recently, and then there's some more in the forecast here. Who's going to get rain? Who doesn't? And does it really matter very much?
Well, I guess it still does matter because of the way it's been hampering field work in parts of Iowa where it's been so wet. And it has contributed to some disappointing yields, I guess, in some of those wetter areas of corn especially, and even parts of Illinois. There's quite a difference between those areas west of the river, Illinois River, that had some wetness and yields not coming in as well as they are in other places where it's been a little bit drier. But we do have more rain in the forecast. First of all, we've got to get out of today's minor heat wave here, which is approaching record temperatures in Illinois, temperatures getting up into the 90s. And the records are mostly around 91 and 92 for the date, so some of the stations may have touched that. We've got these temperatures 90 right up into Chicago today. There is a cold front coming, and ahead of the cold front there'll be some showers. They've moved into central Iowa. They'll make slow eastward progress into eastern Iowa and then in western Illinois. Probably get across the Mississippi River early tonight, and then maybe get as far as Peoria around midnight and over into eastern Illinois in the early morning hours. I'm not looking for very much in the way of precipitation. There'll be some showers and thunderstorms with these, and of course you get variable amounts with that, but I'm not looking for much in excess of maybe 3/4 of an inch and with some of the heavier showers. And all that stuff moves on off then as we move into the weekend, moves off to the east, and then it's going to get pretty wet over in eastern portions of the Midwest. But except for another episode of showers with the actual cold front following this squall line tonight, tomorrow night we'll see some more showers, and they'll be all over by Sunday. And then as we move back into the week, it's going to warm up. We're going to cool off quite significantly, by the way, tomorrow and tomorrow night, when temperatures actually dipping a little below normal for this time of year. But they'll be back above normal by the end of next week.
You have just about a minute and a half left. You can either jump to China and talk about their crop, a soybean, or you can go to South America and talk about their crop, soybean.
Well, okay, on the soybean issue, let's do South America. This is for China. They have had some problems with rain delaying harvesting in the northern areas of the southeastern Brazilian soybean region, and that has finally ended. It's gotten drier, and they're getting back in the fields. It'll get that stuff done pretty well. The rain has shifted now into southeastern Brazil, into the southern states, and there, well, the rain is good for the spring crops, but It's still been hampering some of the late field work that needs to be done with the beans. So all told, I guess what we saw a week or two ago, there's not much change. I think, if anything, maybe there's some improvements in the soybean crop down there.
Pete, thanks so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And we'll talk again with you in 1 week.
Mm-hmm.
Pete Leavitt, agricultural meteorologist, joins us here on the Closing Market Report. Happens each and every Thursday morning. Stay with us if you can for the farming world. If not, you can always pick it up off our website at WILLAG.org. Have a safe afternoon. The following program is an archived edition of The Farming World. This is The Farming World news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk about next-generation renewable energy sources. John Ashworth is here to discuss the work of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. The NRL is the nation's primary lab for renewable energy and energy efficiency research and development. The lab is located in Golden, Colorado. Mr. Ashworth, thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Can you tell me a bit about the lab and its background?
We were created in 1977. The laboratory originally started out as the Solar Energy Research Institute, so obviously it was initially working on primarily on solar energy, but it quickly diversified off into a whole full range of renewable energy technologies. We're about 1,700 people. Biomass conversion, which is the area where I work, is the second largest part of the laboratory. We still have a large research program in solar conversion. Biomass is the next largest area. It's got about 140 full-time researchers and postdocs working here. And we work on all the ways that you can convert biomass into fuel. So biochemical conversion, which is fermentation, primarily, thermochemical conversion, which is high temperature processes for taking material, making it into a gas, and then converting the gas or the liquid into a fuel. And then we've restarted our program on algae conversion. So we are working on how do you take algae and make it into a fuel that can be put into a car or into a tractor or things like that.
Is it a government agency?
We are funded by the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy, I am not an employee of the Department of Energy. We are run by Battelle Research and by the Midwest Research Institute, but the funding is primarily from the Department of Energy. We also do have funding from industrial partners, but, you know, 90 to 95% of the funding is from the federal government.
95% of the funding comes from the federal government, and who do you partner with?
Primarily, we partner with people we partner with universities. We also partner with companies who are looking to develop new technologies or to test new technologies before they go out into the marketplace. Part of our job is to reduce risk. Part of what we do is we're an applied laboratory, so we're not just doing kind of fundamental research on this is the nature of the universe. We're really looking to develop technologies and methodologies that can be applied to making fuels. So in our case, transportation fuels. And we work with companies, they have an idea, they've developed the technology to a certain point. We can help them scale up that technology, figure out what is working, what's not working, what needs to be changed, before they go out and try to raise money to, you know, take it out into the marketplace.
I may have jumped ahead of myself. Do you do research on your own without partners as well? I may have jumped ahead.
No, that's fine. The answer is yes. We have a basic research program, and that research program primarily is focused on converting non-food biomass into fuels. So making cellulosic ethanol from corn stover, wheat straw, switchgrass, wood chips. We've probably been the leading center in the world in that area since the early 1980s. And we have a pilot plant here, two pilot plants, as a matter of fact, where you can scale up those technologies to, say, a ton a day of material coming in the door. and all the pieces that go along with that process, you know, we can do.
So let's talk more about this type of research. This is second-generation biofuels, meaning that it's not looking, as you said, at the seed. And in this case, we're used in our part of the world of talking about ethanol produced from corn or the corn seed. But you're talking about taking the plant itself as opposed to the corn, harvesting
Correct.
The corn, using it for feed or other products, and then taking the plant, what you would call the stover, or the cellulosic part, and converting that into energy. It was something that quite some time ago we thought would be 5 years away and hasn't really come to fruition at this point. How close are we?
We're getting pretty close. Our best estimate, the way we try to we try to calculate cost. Everything we do here is based on not on cost. And our best estimate is that if you started with corn stover today and you paid the farmer for the corn stover, so you're not getting it for free, and you built a 2,000-ton-a-day plant to convert that corn stover to ethanol, that ethanol would cost you about $2.40 per gallon today. Still too expensive unless the price of oil goes way back up. But we're thinking that within the next 2 years, we can get the price down to about $1.50 per gallon. And at that price, including the capital cost, including the operating cost, including a small profit margin for the operator of the factory, so at that cost, it would be cost competitive with oil at $70 a barrel. And since oil is currently $86 a barrel, life would be good. So we think within the next 2 years, the technology that's out there will start coming online. There will be several medium-sized plants that should be up and running by 2012 using some of the technology that was developed here but also developed, you know, by companies themselves. So, and we think once somebody demonstrates it, the investment capital will become, you know, readily available and people will start building factories. So we see this as a 2-3-4 year process before a lot of these come online. There are 23 cellulosic ethanol plants that are either in the design or construct phase. A number of these are small, so they're pilot, somebody trying to prove a process, a concept. Some of them are larger. There's several at 700 tons a day that have actually gone through the permitting process and are getting ready to start construction. Actually, one of them has started construction, the others will start this summer. So it's getting there. And then in addition to that, there are other technologies that are further out that are more third-generation technology, so people who are looking not to make ethanol, but to make something like jet fuel, or making diesel fuel, or making gasoline directly from biomass. So those are a little bit further out, but there's a lot of people raising a lot of money to build those facilities.
Now, one of the expertise that I read in our EL claims it brings to the table, and you talked a bit about it, was your modeling expertise, and mm-hmm. I think you call it techno-economics. Can you explain
yes.
something about that?
Yeah. One of the things we learned a long time ago is that it's not enough to say that a technology works. You have to understand how the economics bear out in a large-scale setting. So about 10 years ago, we took some standard industrial modeling software. It's used by companies like DuPont and Dow Chemical and people like that to do their process modeling when they build a factory. So this is standard industrial software. And what we did is we developed models for all the conversion processes that you use to start from, say, a piece of wood and go, or a piece of corn stover and go to ethanol, whether it's thermochemical or biochemical. And it looks at all the mass and heat energy that's being moved around inside the factory and tries to understand where it goes. So you can't cheat on this software. It doesn't let you. And then we attach real costs from real marketplaces. So we go out to vendors and say, if we bought a piece of a grinder from you, what would you charge us for a piece of grinder that's this big? And then we put that into the model. We run the factory for a year in the model, and then it says, okay, what does the fuel end up costing? you've bought the capital, you have to pay the bank off for the capital, you have to have operating costs, you buy the feedstock, you have to clean up the wastewater, all the things that are normal with operating a factory. And then we just use that and we back calculate the cost of the fuel. And what we do every time we do a research project here, before we do it, we run the model and we say, okay, if this research project increases the efficiency of the conversion from 80% to 85%, what does that do to the cost of ethanol? Does it get us to closer to our targets? If so, then we can do the research. If it doesn't get us closer, we don't do it. So the whole point is drive down the cost.
So your research is really applied and not the basic type of research that would need to be done to explore really the newest technologies or those that haven't been developed yet or haven't been thought of yet. Is that right?
Well, we do some of that basic research, and we do it in order to feed into the more applied. So the best example is enzymes. When you break down some material like switchgrass or wheat straw or stover, you have to break apart these long chains of material down into simple sugars so the organism can eat them. The way you do that is with enzymes. The issue is nobody really understood how enzymes work, the actual mechanics of how they do their job. It's an amazingly complex process, and it's a biological process developed over millions of years. So we actually have tools here at the laboratory which allow us to go down almost to the atomic level, but certainly to the molecular level, where we can watch how the enzymes are working, and then we can make recommendations to enzyme companies about how to improve their enzymes because we understand better the actual mechanics of how these proteins are working in real time. And by doing that, we've been able to help the enzyme companies greatly increase the efficiency of their enzymes, which has made them cheaper. So, you know, the goal is to make it cheaper, but some of the science that goes into this is extremely high-tech and advanced, but the goal is always the same. The goal is always to get the materials and the processes less expensive.
The enzymes are difficult because oftentimes what they end up producing is, well, deadly to the enzyme?
No, enzymes are difficult because they were developed by organisms, usually fungi or things like that, in order for them to, you know, to eat. So, you know, I always tell people, if you think of, you take a tree and it falls in the forest, and you come back 20 years later, the part of the tree is gone. And the reason that tree is gone is that naturally occurring organisms in the forest have the ability to break down wood and eat it. And you know, and what they do is they make enzymes. Well, they do that very slowly. So it takes 20 years for a tree to break down in the forest. We're trying to break down these materials in 2 days. So you need enzymes that go much faster than the traditional, you know, enzymes did in nature. And that's what enzyme companies do. They try to figure out how to speed up the enzymes, how to make the organisms produce more of them. And when they do produce them, they work better. And so what we try to do is support that. And it's just complex proteins, you know, and those proteins are naturally occurring, but now they might work 100 times faster than they did in the wild. So the idea is we can help that process along, and by doing so, the enzyme companies will scale up their technology, they'll make more of it, they'll make it cheaper, and so that enables people who want to build a factory to make a less expensive fuel.
This afternoon, we're talking with John Ashworth. He's with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. You're listening to The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. More in a moment.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
A programming note here, the farming world will end after a six-month run on the first day of October. That's a week from tomorrow. Here's what the weather forecast looks like for this evening in the Urbana-Champaign area tonight. As the National Weather Service reports, showers and thunderstorms are likely this evening after 1 a.m. It'll be mostly cloudy skies tonight, a low of 67 degrees, south-southwest winds between 14 and 18 miles an hour. Those winds will gust as high as 25. The chance of precipitation across the area, 70%. Tomorrow, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms, that before 1 p.m. in the afternoon. Cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny as the day wears on. A high near 78 degrees tomorrow. Breezy west winds between 15 and 20 miles an hour. They'll gust up to about 26. On Friday night, football evening, mostly clear skies, a low of 51. Northwest winds between 6 and 10. Saturday, sky should be sunny, the high near 73, partly cloudy skies Saturday evening, a low of 50. Sunday, for the rest of the weekend, a 30% chance of showers, partly sunny skies, high near 71. And by the time we get to Sunday evening, the lows will be 48 degrees with a chance of showers on Monday to start the work week. A chance of showers, partly sunny, a high near 68, a lot cooler than today. And Monday night, a low of 53. Chance of showers, mostly cloudy skies. That's a look at the weather forecast for the Urbana-Champaign area. You're listening to Illinois Public Media. The following program is an archived edition of The Farming World.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with John Ashworth. He's with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. Mr. Ashworth, when we left, you were discussing enzymes and risk involved in all the kinds of things that have to do with second-generation fuels. We haven't taken up really, I think, maybe what is the point of the NREL, which is to help companies avoid some of the financial risk that comes along with developing these types of products. How do you do that?
Well, let me give you an example. Maybe that would be helpful. If you want to build a large-scale cellulosic ethanol plant today, using today's technology, that plant will cost anywhere from $300 million to $500 million, whereas a corn ethanol plant today costs a 50-million-gallon plant would cost $100 million, a 100-million-gallon plant would cost $200 million. So these plants would be more expensive initially because of the capital. Bankers and other people are not willing to invest that kind of money unless they know that the technology works and it works at scale. So what we do here is we work with companies as they're developing technology and we help them scale it up. So if somebody is developing a new approach, they might be operating it in their laboratory at, say, 10-liter scale, which is 2.5 gallons. Okay, that doesn't mean much to a banker. So we have the ability here to scale that technology up first to 100 liters. We have 100-liter fermenters here. We can look at them, make suggestions, help people out with their approach, make it more efficient. Then we can scale it up to, say, 1,000 liters. Again, we have that in-house. And then we can scale it up to 10,000 liters, which is 2,500 gallons. And at that point, you're beginning to run into the real issues that you run into when you run a factory. The mixing issues, the, you know, transporting the material from point A to point B, moving it around. And so at that scale, you are really beginning to get data that's important. Because when you get to that scale, then you can take that money to an investor and say, see, the technology works. We're getting 75 gallons per ton of raw material. We've tried out different raw materials. The process works on different raw materials. NREL scientists have validated these numbers. They can tell you these are real. And then we can calculate out our best guess of what the cost of the production is. We're not going to get it perfectly right. But so that's how we help. We're really good at the the engineering part of understanding how to do this. Sometimes you're working with companies that are very good at the biology part. They understand how a microorganism works, or they have a very good enzyme, or you're dealing with the people who develop the feedstock. So, for example, there's a number of people right now who are developing new crops out there designed specifically for making fuels. So we recently had a large, very successful project with the National Sorghum Producers where they were looking at different varieties of sorghum and trying to understand if they would be easily converted into ethanol. Not grain sorghum necessarily, but other kinds of sorghum like forage sorghum, sweet sorghum. So we brought these things into our facility here. We tested them. We fermented them at small scales. We ran them through our pretreatment reactors. And then we ran a one-ton-a-day run of one of the more promising materials, and we calculated out the yields and the costs. And this is a really good feedstock. So, you know, we basically now enable people who are interested in developing one of these plants to have an additional feedstock that they hadn't thought about before. So this would be like forage sorghum.
So
go ahead.
So what you do in general is you provide the risk capital for the development of the technology, but not the development, not the capital to put up a plant. Is that correct?
Well, we develop the risk expertise rather than the capital. Sometimes the Department of Energy pays for some of these studies. Sometimes the company themselves pays for these studies. But what we're really good at is doing the work. We've done this for 20 years. We know how to do it. So somebody can come in here and very quickly understand what is right and wrong with their process, where areas they have to improve. In some cases, we can develop that process for them, or we can work with their scientists or their engineers to develop that. So we're really more trying to help industry. There's a famous expression called the valley of death in technology, and it means that you get the technology to a certain stage, and then you don't know what to do from there, and you run out of money, and you disappear. What we're trying to do is help companies across that valley of death so they can get to the point where they can prove their technology at a large enough scale that they can get funding to build a commercial plant.
Mr. Ashworth, thank you so much for your time today. We do appreciate you talking about the National Renewable Energy Laboratory with us.
My pleasure.
John Ashworth is a team leader for NREL's Bioenergy Center. He joined us from his Golden, Colorado office. You've been listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. The Farming World is coming to an end on the first day of October after a six-month run. We thank you for your support, and we look forward to the advancement of our core mission, distributing regionally, nationally, and internationally information and analysis of commodity markets and agricultural weather. When the situation warrants, you can rest assured we'll follow key agricultural topics and stories, and we'll make room for discussions with those that influence the political spectrum of agriculture in the closing market report, which remains in its traditional 206 to 236 time slot. Again, thank you for your support as we wrap up The Farming World.